This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents The Star-Touched Queen by Roshni Chokshi. Read for you by Priya Iyer. Part 1. The Lost Princess. Chapter 1. Not a Ghost. Staring at the sky in Bharata was like exchanging a secret. It felt private, like I had peered through the veil of 100 worlds. When I looked up, I could imagine, for a moment, what the sky hid from everyone else. I could see where the winds yawned with silver lips and curled themselves to sleep. I could glimpse the moon folding herself into crescents and half-smiles. When I looked up, I could imagine an existence as vast as the sky, just as infinite, just as unknown. But today there was no time to let my head wander. Duty kept my gaze fixed on the funeral pyre, slowly winding its way toward the harem. I choked back a cough. Charred incense filled my lungs, thick and oversweet with the smell of burning marigolds. Beside the pyre, mourners screeched and wept, tearing their hair and smearing ash across their faces. It was an impressive show, but their bored eyes betrayed them. Hired help, no doubt. Real grief had no place in my father's court. An ivory screen separated the harem from the funerary procession, but I caught snatches of him through the lattice. He wore a white Sherwani jacket, and around his throat coiled a necklace strung together with the birthstones of his children. There, by the crook of his neck, my birthstones, a handful of muted sapphires, caught the watery morning light. My father's head was bent to the ear of a pale-faced courtier, his voice low. He wasn't talking about the dead wife on the pyre. He probably didn't even know her name. It was Padmavati. She had a round face and used to sing in the morning, crooning to her swelling stomach with a secret smile. I never once heard her say a cruel thing about anyone, not even me. No, my father was discussing war. The shadow of it looms over us constantly, sometimes hidden, always present. I only know of the war in glimpses, but I see its pall everywhere. I see war in my father's face, pinching his cheek sallow. I see war in the courtier's brows, always bent in grief. I see war in the empty coffers, in the tents where once-spirited soldiers await the crematory grounds. I leaned closer to catch his words, only to be yanked back.
"Get away from there," Mother Dina hissed. "It's not right for you to stand at the front."
My jaw tightened, but I stepped back without a word. I couldn't risk giving the wives more venom. They may have covered their lips with silk, but their words were unsheathed daggers. According to the royal physician, childbirth had killed Padmavati, but no one believed him. In the eyes of the court, there was only one killer. Me. In Bharata, no one believed in ghosts, because the dead never lingered. Lives were remade instantly, souls unzipped and tipped into the streaked brilliance of a tiger, a gopi with lacquered eyes, or a raja with a lap full of jewels. I couldn't decide whether I thought reincarnation was a scare tactic or a hopeful message. Do this so you won't come back as a cockroach. Give alms to the poor, and in your next life you'll be rich. It made all good deeds seem suspect. Even then it was a comfort to know that there were no ghosts in my country. It meant that I was alive. To everyone else, I was a dead girl walking. But I was no ghost. I was no spectral imprint of something that had lived and died and couldn't leave this place behind. It meant I still had a chance at life. By the time the funerary procession ended, the sun had barely begun to edge its way across the sky. The mourners had dispersed as soon as the royal announcement ended, and only the flames presided over Padmavati's burial. When the noonday bell rang throughout the palace, even the smells, smoke and petals, salt and jasmine, had disappeared, scraped up by the wind and carried far into the shadowless realm of the dead. Before me, The halls of the harem glittered, sharp as a predator's eyes. Light clung to the curved torsos of statuettes and skimmed the reflections from still pools of water. In the distance, the great double doors of the harem yawned open, and the mellow midday heat crept in from the outside. I could never trust the stillness of the harem. Behind me, the living quarters and personal rooms of the harem wives and my half-sisters had melted into shadow. The caretakers had set the children of the royal nursery to sleep. The tutors had begun droning to the betrothed princesses about the lands and ancestries of their soon-to-be husbands. I had my own appointment. My tutor of the week. Poor things. They never lasted long. Whether that was their decision or mine just depended on the person. It wasn't that I disliked learning. It was simply that they couldn't teach me what I wanted to know. My real place of study hovered above their heads, literally. Outside, the thunder of clashing gongs drifted through the harem walls. Parrots scattered from their naps, launching into the air with a huff and a screech. The familiar shuffle of pointed shoes, golden tassels, and nervous voices melted into a low murmur. All of my father's counselors were making their way to the throne room for his announcement. Within moments, my father would reveal his solution for dealing with the rebel kingdoms. My heart jostled. Father, while never on time, was nonetheless efficient. He wouldn't waste time on the frivolities of the court, which meant that I had a limited amount of time to get to the throne room, and I still had to deal with the most recent tutor. I prayed he was a simpleton. Better yet, superstitious. Father once said the real language of diplomacy was in the space between words. He said silence was key to politics. Silence, I had learned, was also key to spying. I slipped off anything noisy, gold bracelets, dangling earrings, and stashed them behind a stone carving of a mina bird. Navigating through the harem was like stepping into a riddle. Niches filled with statues of gods and goddesses with plangent eyes and backs arced in a forgotten reel of a half-dance leaned out into the halls. Light refracted off crystal platters, piled with blooms the bright color of new blood, and flickering diyas cast smoke against the mirrors, leaving the halls a snarl of mist and petals. I touched the sharp corners. I liked the feeling of stone beneath my fingers, of something that pushed back to remind me of my own solidity. As I rounded the last corner, the harem wives' sharp laughter leapt into the halls, sending prickles across my arm. The harem wives' habits never changed. It was the one thing I liked about them. My whole life was crafted around their boredom. I could probably set my heartbeat to the hours they whittled away exchanging gossip. Before I could run past them, a name rooted me to the spot. My own. At least I thought I heard it. I couldn't be sure. No matter how much I wanted to plant one foot in front of the other and leave them behind, I couldn't. I held my breath and stepped backward, pressing my ear as close to the curtains as I could. "It's a pity," said a voice sultry from years spent smoking the rose-scented water pipes. Mother Dina. She ruled the harem with an iron fist. She may not have given the Raja any sons, but she had one enduring quality, life. She had survived 7 pregnancies, 2 stillbirths, and a sweating sickness that claimed 8 wives in the past 3 years. Her word was law.
"What is?"
A simpering voice, Mother Shastri, second in command. She was one of the younger wives, but had recently given birth to 2 sons. She was far more conniving than Mother Dina, but lacked all the ambition of real malice.
"It's just a pity. Adviti didn't go the same way as Padmavati."
My hands curled into fists, nails sinking into the flesh of my palms. Adviti. I didn't know her long enough to call her mother. I knew nothing of her except her name and a vague rumor that she had not gotten along with the other wives. In particular, Mother Dina. Once, they had been rivals. Even after she died, Mother Dina never forgave her. Other than that, she was a nondescript dream in my head. Sometimes when I couldn't sleep at night, I'd try to conjure her, but nothing ever revealed itself to me, not the length of her hair or the scent of her skin. She was a mystery, and the only thing she left me was a necklace and a name. Instinctively, my fingers found her last gift, a round-cut sapphire strung with seed pearls. Mother Dina wheezed, and when she spoke, I could almost smell the smoke puffing out between her teeth.
"Usually when a woman dies in childbirth, the child goes too."
Mother Shastri chided her with a hollow tisk.
"It's not good to say such things, sister."
"And why is that?" came a silvery voice. I couldn't place that one. She must have been new.
"It should have been a good thing for a child to survive the mother. It is a shame Padmavati's son died with her." "Who is Advaiti?"
"Was,"
corrected Mother Dina with a tone like thunder. The other wife stuttered into silence.
"She was nothing more than a courtesan who caught the Raja's eye. Mayavati is her daughter."
"Her? The one with the horoscope?"
Another wife's voice leapt to join the others.
"Is it true that she killed Padmavati?"
Bharata may not believe in ghosts, but horoscopes were entirely different. The kingdom choreographed whole lives on whatever central axis was assigned to you. Father didn't seem to believe in horoscopes. He spoke of destiny as a malleable thing, something that could be bent, interpreted, or loosened to any perspective. But that didn't change the mind of the court. Whatever magic had unearthed meaning in stars, my celestial forecast was shadowed and torn, and the wives never let me forget. It made me hate the stars and curse the night sky.
"She might as well have," said Mother Dina dismissively. "That kind of bad fortune only attracts ill luck."
"Is it true, then?"
How many times had I asked myself that question? I tried to convince myself that it was just the idle talk of the harem wives and a series of bad coincidences, but sometimes I wasn't so sure.
"The Raja needs to get rid of her," said Mother Shastri, "before her plague spreads to someone else."
"How can he?" scoffed another. "Who would marry her with that horoscope? She brings death wherever she goes."
The new wife with the silvery voice piped up eagerly.
"I heard her shadow doesn't stay in one place."
Another voice chimed in.
"A servant told me that snakes bow to her."
I pushed myself off the wall. I knew all the rumors, and I didn't care to hear them again. Their words crawled over my skin. I wanted to shake off the insults, the laughter, the shadows, but all of it clung to me, thick as smoke, pushing out the blood from my veins until I pulsed with hate. The second gong rang in the distance. I walked faster, feet pounding on the marble. As I ran through the gardens, sunlight slanted off my skin, and a feeling of wrongness struck me. It didn't dawn on me until afterward, until light knifed through the fig trees and striped me like a tiger, until I caught the shadow-seamed imprint of a leaf against the paved walkway to the archival buildings. My shadow. I couldn't see it. Chapter 2. Lessons in Silence. The archives were cut like honeycombs, and golden light clung to them, dousing every tome, painting, treatise, and poem, the soft gold of ghee freshly skimmed from boiling butter. I was only allowed to visit once a week, to meet with my weekly tutor before I inevitably scared him away. Every time I left the archival room, my arms brimmed with parchment paper. I loved the feeling of discovery, of not knowing how much I wanted something until I had discovered its absence. The week before, I had lost myself in the folk tales of Bharata. Stories of elephants who spun clouds, shaking tremors loose from ancient trunks, gnarled with the rhyme of lost cyclones, whirlwinds, and thunderstorms. Myths of frank-eyed Naga women, twisting serpentine, flashing smiles full of uncut gemstones. Legends of a world beneath, above, beside the one I knew, where trees bore edible gems, and no one would think twice about a girl with dark skin and a darker horoscope. I wanted it to be real so badly that sometimes I thought I could see the other world. Sometimes, if I closed my eyes and pressed my toes into the ground, I could almost sense them sinking into the loam of some other land. A dream domain where the sky cleaved in two, and the earth was sutured with a magic that could heal hearts, mend bones, change lives. It was a dream I didn't want to part with, but I had to settle for what magic I could create on my own. I could read more, learn more, make new dreams. But the best part wasn't hoarding those wishes to myself. It was sharing everything I learned with Gauri, my half-sister. She was the only one I couldn't scare away, the only one I didn't want to. Thinking of Gauri always made me smile, but as soon as I caught sight of my tutor of the week, the smile disappeared. He stood between two pillars of the archive section, marking the kingdom's history. Beyond the sheer number of things to read in the archive room, what I loved most was its ceiling. It was empty, wide enough to crawl through, and conveniently linked to my father's inner sanctum. The tutor, as luck would have it, stood directly below my hiding spot. At least father's announcement hadn't started. The courtiers still murmured, and the footfall of tardiness fell on my ears like music. But if I was ever going to get to hear that meeting, I had to get rid of the tutor first.
"Punctuality is a prize among women," said the tutor.
I bit back a cringe. His voice was sticky, the words drawn out like they would morph into a noose and slip around you in the dark. I stepped back only to see his eyes sharpen into a glare. He was heavy-set and tall. Soft, rounded jowls faded into a non-chin and thick neck. Greasy black eyes dragged across my body. In the past, my tutors had all been the same. A little doughy, a little nervous, always superstitious. This new tutor held my gaze evenly. That was unexpected. None of my other tutors had ever met my eye. Sometimes the tutors sidled against the dark of the archival chambers, hands trembling as they pushed a set of notes toward me. History lessons, they said. Why did they always start with history? Show me a dream unrealized. Don't show me unchangeable paths. The tutor cleared his throat.
"I have no intention to teach you history or letters or speech. I intend to teach you silence. Stillness."
This time I didn't even try to hide my scowl. I did not like this replacement. Tutors generally left me alone. I never had to raise my voice. I never had to scowl. I didn't even need words. What scared them most was much simpler and sweeter than that. A smile. The moment I smiled, not a real one, of course, but a slow, crocodile reveal of teeth and a practiced, manic gleam, the tutor would make an excuse, edge along the wall, and flee out of the archive rooms. Who wanted to be smiled at by the girl that trailed shadows like pets, conjured snakes, and waited for death, her bridegroom, to steal her from these walls? Never mind that none of it was true. Never mind that the closest I had come to real magic was making off with an entire tray of desserts without anyone noticing. The shadow of me always loomed larger than the person who cast it, and sometimes that had its benefits. This tutor, however, was not as easily cowed. I strained my ears, listening for the footfall of more courtiers, but it was silent. The meeting would start any minute now, and here I was, stuck with some fool who wanted to teach me the virtue of silence. I grinned at him. And he grinned back.
"It is unseemly to smile at strangers, princess."
He took a step closer to me. Shadows glommed around him, choking off the honey light of the room. He smelled wrong, like he had borrowed the scent of another person. Sweat slicked his skin, and when he walked closer, red shimmered in his eyes, like coal smoldering in each socket.
"Let me teach you, lovely thing," he said, taking another step closer. "Humans always get it wrong, don't they? They think a bowl of rice at the front door is strong enough to keep a demon away. Wrong. What you know is a false promise of strength. Let me show you weakness."
The room had never felt this empty, like I was trapped between the space of an echo and a scream. I couldn't hear anything, not the parrots scuttling on their branches or the court notary droning his list of the afternoon's agenda. Silence was a silhouette, something I could trace. The tutor's voice transcended sound, muddying my thoughts.
"Let me teach you the ways of demons and men."
My knees buckled. His voice echoed with all the desperation of someone who had not slaked his thirst in eons and had just spied a goblet of water sweating beads of condensation, thick as planets. His voice lulled me, coded me. I wanted to move, but found myself rooted to the spot. I glanced up, fighting the drowsiness, and saw his shadow smeared on the wall. Horned, furred belly skating over the floor, shifting into man and beast and back. Devil. Raksha. Somewhere in my mind, I knew he wasn't real. He couldn't be. This was the court of Bharata, a city like a bone spur, tacked on like an afterthought. Its demons were different. Harem wives with jewels in their hair and hate in their heart. Courtiers with mouths full of lies. A father who knew me only as a colored stone around his neck. Those were the monsters I knew. My world didn't have room for more. The drowsiness slipped off me. When I shook myself free of it, my smile was bitter smoke, my hackles raised, until I thought my skin had given way to glass. Now he seemed smaller, or maybe I had grown bigger. My surroundings slid away, and all that was left was fire licking at the earth, the edge of a winter eclipse, stars whirling in a forest pool, and the pulsing beat of something ancient running through my veins.
"I don't care for the ways of men and demons," I hissed. "Your lessons are lost on me."
Whatever darkness my mind had imagined melted. Parrots singing, fountains gurgling, the distant voice of a courtier droning about wars. Sound pushed up between those lost seconds, blossoming into fierce murmurs, hushed tones. What had I imagined? I searched for the tutor's shadow splayed against the wall. I waited to see something slinking along the ground. Darkness stretched long and thin over tomes and cracked tiles, but there was nothing.
"You," he hissed in an exhale that ended in a whimper. He backed into a corner. "It's you. I thought..."
He gulped down the rest of his words. He looked lost. I blinked at him, shaking off the final remnants of that drowsiness. I felt groggy, but not with sleep. A moment ago, I thought I had seen horns limbed in shadow. I thought something had coursed through me in defense. A low note of music, the bass of a thunderclap, a pleat of light glinting through a bruised storm cloud. But that couldn't be right. The person before me was just a person. And if I had heard him say something else, saw him morph into something else, it was all distant, and the fingers of my memory could do nothing but rummage through images, hold them to the light, and wonder if I hadn't slipped into a waking nightmare. The tutor trembled. Gone was the blocky figure choking out the light and lecturing me on silence. Or had he said something else in those lost moments? Something about weakness and demons? I couldn't remember. I clutched a table, my knuckles white.
"I must go," he said, his face pale like blood had drained from him. "I didn't know. Truly, I didn't. I thought you were someone else."
I stared at him. What did he mean? How could he not know who I was? Someone must have told him that I was the princess he would be tutoring this afternoon. But I was wasting time. He was just another tutor, scared by a reputation pronounced by faraway lights in the sky. Curse the stars.
"Leave," I said. "Inform the court that we completed a full session, but that other commitments prevent you from teaching me again. Do you understand?"
He nodded, his hand still raised to his face like he thought I would hit him at any moment. Then he bowed, stumbling backward. He stood in the arch of the doorway, body cast in shadow, face in inscrutable inkblot. He bowed once more before I blinked and realized he was gone. Nothing. Not even that telltale seep of cold that invaded a room when another body had just left. I kneaded my hands against my forehead, rubbing out the shadows of horned silhouettes and flashing eyes. I couldn't shake the sense that the world had split for a moment, separating like oil and water. A moment passed before I shook myself of that strange grogginess with a horrifying jolt. The announcement. My heart lurched. How much had I missed? I spared one last glance at the arch of light where the tutor had disappeared. Perhaps he was just more superstitious than normal. There had been a funeral, after all. That was all. That was all. I repeated the words in my head, bright as talismans, until I had all but forgotten the feeling of two worlds converging across my eyes, dazzling and prismatic. I pulled myself up the ladder propped against the shelves that led directly to the hollowed roof and rafters of my father's inner sanctum. The wood beneath my palms was rough and scratchy. I gripped the rungs tighter, smiling when splinters slid into my hands. I am here. I am no ghost. Ghosts don't get splinters. Heart calm, hands still, I slid through the loose space in the rafters, kicked my feet behind me, and disappeared into the ceiling. The first time I had snuck up the rafters, my heart raced so fast. I almost didn't hear all the debates between the courtiers, the advisers, and my father. Women weren't allowed in the inner court sanctum, and getting caught would mean severe punishment. Over time, sneaking above the sanctum became easy. Now, I could wriggle my way through the empty space like a blind lizard. Safely perched in the rafters, I curled my knees beneath me and snuggled into my hiding spot. I didn't know how many hours I had spent perched in this corner, listening to them. Up here, I could pretend that I ruled over them all, silent and mythic. From here, I could learn what no tutor could teach, the way power settles over people in a room, the way language curls around ankles like a sated cat, or flicks a forked tongue in caution, the way to enthrall an audience. And I could understand, almost, the lives and history scrawled into the lines and lines of the records stowed away in the archival building. The inner sanctum was where my father met foreign dignitaries. It was where the war meetings were held, where crops were discussed, and decisions were made. It was the heart of the kingdom, and at its throne, my father. According to the archives, he had ruled since the age of 10. If he had siblings, the records never mentioned them. I flattened myself against the wall and settled in to listen. Whatever I had missed from the beginning had taken its toll on the courtiers. Even from my hiding spot, some faces gleamed white, and the air was thick and sour with anxiety. The inner sanctum held every reminder of the war that had raged on for at least 6 years. Dented helmets lined the walls like iron skulls. It unnerved the courtiers. Some of them refused to sit beside the armor of the dead, but Father had insisted.
"We must never forget those who served us."
Each time I clambered into the rafters, the helmets seemed to grow in size and number. Now they covered the walls from floor to ceiling. Even though they had been cleaned and scraped of blood, their presence haunted the sanctum. Sunlight glinted off the metal, haloing the helmet so that it looked like my father held court before ghosts.
"Sire, we cannot abide by this decision. There must be a different way to end the war," said Ajit, a baby-faced counselor with a receding hairline he hid beneath a massive pagri.
He trembled where he stood. Small hands knotted at the base of his ribs, like he'd sunk a dagger to its hilt far into his belly. Given the flash of anger on the Raja's face, he might as well have.
"We still have enough soldiers," he cried. "The medics have become more skilled. We might even win this war and sacrifice only a few hundred more."
I frowned. Couldn't Ajit see the helmets on the walls? People had filled that armor. Heads, once brimming with their own hopes and joys and miseries, had worn those helmets. What was only a few hundred more to the kingdom could be someone else's lover, brother, or son. It wasn't right to honor the dead with inaction.
"You can and you will abide by my decision," said the Raja, his voice hard.
He looked careworn, dark eyes sunken so that for a moment they looked like the depthless hollows of a skull.
"But
The rebel kingdoms.
The rebel kingdoms want the same thing that we do, said my father harshly. They want food in their bellies, warmth in their hearts. They want their children to live long enough to possess a name. They fight us out of desperation. Who else will hear their pleas? A decade-long drought? Failing crops? Sweating sicknesses?
But, Your Majesty, they turned on the capital.
Exactly. Their desperation means they have nothing to lose. We are the only losers in this war, he said. We cannot fight from the fringes. We need to bring them here. Now do as I say, and arrange the Swayamvara.
A wedding?
His tone sent a frisson of ice down my spine. But all of my half-sisters of marriageable age are already betrothed. The only one who isn't is...
The moment the rebel kingdoms hear about Princess Mayavati's horoscope, they will not go through with the wedding,
said another of my father's advisers, Jayesh. On any other day, I liked him. His voice was soft-spoken, his perspective far more liberal than the rest of the court. But in that moment, I hated him. Hated him for the words that leapt out of his mouth and chained me to the spot. Everyone, including me, had thought my horoscope was enough to ward off any proposals. In 17 years, it hadn't failed me. But now the possibility of a life lived in unwed freedom disappeared, pulled out from under my feet in a matter of seconds.
Your Majesty, I mean no disrespect, but the princess's horoscope is reputed to have foretold a rather disturbing marriage, one that would partner her with death and destruction. We could offend the...
The Raja raised his hand.
Hearsay has no place in diplomacy. Our duty is to our people, and I will not see them harmed because of superstition. We need to bring the enemy to our court. We need to end this war.
End the war. I knew he was right. Even from the sidelines of the court, death pressed all around us. Jayesh bowed and sat down. I knew they were saying other things, exchanging details and days, parsing out my life between them like it was ribbon fit for tearing. It was a miracle I didn't stumble through the gap in the rafters. I knew my father better than most did. I had watched him for years. Beneath one plan was always 10. Usually I could find the cracks in his words, pry them open and see what lay beneath the layers of diplomacy, sweet talk and vengeance. But not now. His voice was monotone, pained almost. He spoke with the finality of stone, and my heart broke beneath it.
The Swayamvara will be in a few days' time, continued the Raja. The rebel leaders will be welcomed as guests and suitors for my daughter's hand. Draw up a new horoscope, and hide any evidence of the original. Make it convincing.
A tremor snaked from my head to my toes. Distantly, the clang of the court notary's bell echoed through the walls. Feet shuffled. Voices, sonorous and hard, yielded and blended into one another until only silence remained in the sanctum. I pulled my knees to my chin, back pressed against the wall. Marriage. All I knew of marriage was what I saw in the harem wives, pettiness and boredom, with only the comfort of silk and gossip. There were times when I saw my betrothed half-sisters lost in thought, their faces aglow with hope and wonder. Maybe they thought they would be leaving Bharata behind, for a new city that would welcome them with sweet-smelling arms and a husband waiting with a smile fashioned just for them. But I had listened to the stories of the wives, and I saw what lay ahead. Another harem. Another husband. Another woman scurried away behind a lattice of elephant bone, staring out to a scene forever marred by the patterns of a gilded cage. I glanced below me at the empty sanctum. In every tomorrow I had imagined, this was never one of them. There were never any prospects beyond the life of a scholarly old maid. But that was a fate I had looked forward to. To live among parchments and sink into the compressed universes stitched into lines and lines of writing. To answer to no one. There was another sorrow tucked beneath my surprise. Although I had never envisioned marriage, I had thought of love. Not the furtive love I heard muffled in the corners or rooms of some of the harem wives. What I wanted was a connection, a shared heartbeat that kept rhythm across oceans and worlds. Not some alliance cobbled out of war. I didn't want the prince from the folktales or some milk-skinned, honey-eyed youth who said his greetings and proclaimed his love in the same breath. I wanted a love thick with time, as inscrutable as if a lathe had carved it from night, and as familiar as the marrow in my bones. I wanted the impossible, which made it that much easier to push out of my mind. Chapter 3. Favored Daughters. Somehow I left behind the rafters and climbed down the rungs and left the honeycombs of Barata's archives. I didn't care if anyone saw me or asked questions. Barata had already discarded me. I was no more than a guest in my father's home, whittling away the time until a palanquin bore me away to a different cage. I was halfway to the harem when I heard feet pounding the walkway behind me.
"Princess Mayavati, the Raja Ramchandra of Bharata requests your immediate presence in the gardens."
I drew my veil over my head before turning. Why did every guard always say the Raja Ramchandra, as if I didn't know my father's name? "Oh, that Raja. I thought you meant one of the other rulers." Fools.
"Now?"
The guard blinked. He was young and handsome in a vague, unmemorable way. I had half a mind to ask if he was going to throw in his name with the pack of wolves that would come to Bartha and claim my hand in the Swayamvara. I must have unknowingly grinned, because the young guard masked a flinch. He probably thought I had unleashed some curse on him.
"Yes, Princess, he's waiting for you in the gardens."
That was new. My father never waited for anyone.
"And if I say no?"
The guard stepped back.
"Don't worry, it was only a question."
"Does that mean—"
"Which is to say," I said slowly, "that I will come with you. Lead the way."
He turned on his heel, and after a moment's hesitation, began marching back down the path. Guilt twinged inside me. He was only doing his duty. He hadn't even done anything openly insulting, like some of the harem wives who would spit on my shadow. I toyed with the idea of apologizing, but thought better of it. My words were out, and that was that. Around us, my father's court shimmered in the early evening. Even though the sun had gone, the sky remained a rich turmeric yellow. A bright vermilion peeled at the edges of the clouds, fading somewhere into the tangle of trees. Around me, the silver reflection pools lapped up the last light, and in its waters burned flat flames. The entrance to the gardens of Bharata was cleverly constructed, so that the gates marking it looked like a snarl of roses at first glance. On closer inspection, wrought iron bloomed beneath the petals, before snaking upward to bolster the trees, fig and neem, sweet almond and tart lime, into living pergolas. My father's guards circled the gardens. In their scarlet robes, they looked like vicious trees poised to spear the sun should it fall.
"One moment, Princess," said the guard quickly. "I believe His Highness is concluding a discussion on matters of state with the Crown Prince."
Beneath my veil, I arched an eyebrow. If my father was discussing anything with the Crown Prince, it would be his extravagant ledger. Without waiting for an answer, the guard bowed awkwardly and left. The moment I knew I was alone, I left the path, following the harsh voice of the Raja to a secluded copse of trees. In the middle of the clearing, my half-brother cowered in the Raja's shadow, his head bent as he toyed with the sleeves of his jacket.
"How dare you embarrass us?" the Raja thundered.
"It wasn't my fault, Father. That peasant disrespected me. He sneezed."
"Yes, but on my jacket."
Skanda, my half-brother, was a fool. Where the Raja favored wisdom, Skanda favored wealth. Where the Raja listened, Skanda leered.
"Would you like to know the difference between us and everyone else?"
demanded the Raja.
Yes?
Nothing whatsoever.
But the worms do not take heed of caste and rank when they feast on our ashes, the Raja said. Your subjects will not remember you. They will not remember the shade of your eyes, the colors you favored, or the beauty of your wives. They will only remember your impression upon their hearts, and whether you filled them with glee or grief. That is your immortality.
With that, he strode out of the grove. I ran back to the garden's path, out of breath and hoping he hadn't noticed my presence. By now, the sun had slipped behind the palace, transforming everything that surrounded it to a rosy gold. As the Raja approached, I saw him as I always did, illuminated and beyond reproach. But as he came closer, new details leapt forward. There were weary creases at the corners of his eyes, and a new slope to his shoulders. It didn't look right. I felt like I was truly seeing him for the first time, and what I saw was a man stooped in age, wearing a thinning pelt of greatness. The moment our eyes met, I averted my gaze. Seeing him like this made me feel as if I had stumbled into something private, something I wasn't supposed to know, or perhaps just didn't want to. I knelt before him, the tips of my fingers brushing against his feet in the customary symbol of respect and deference.
"It is good to see you, daughter," he said.
I knew my father in his voice, in his words. The moment he spoke, all of the previous strangeness was forgotten. My father was not known for a pleasing diplomatic tone. His voice had the gravelly lurch of a thunderclap and all the solemnity of sleep, but the sound clung to me in a well-worn familiarity. It lulled me into safety, and for a moment I thought he would say that his meeting with the courtiers had been a sham, that he had no intention of marrying me off to strangers, that I would stay here forever. This was no heaven, but it was the hell that I knew, and I preferred it far more than whatever beast of a country awaited me. All of that half-hope slipped away with his next words.
"In the manner of the old kings, we are holding a swayamvara for you," he said. "You will get the chance to choose your own husband, Mayavati."
His voice filled the courtyard. Cold sweat turned my palms clammy, and my practiced calm fell away. My mind scrambled for an escape, but everything felt too close, too slippery, and worst of all, hopelessly out of reach. He stared at me expectantly.
"Yes, father," I forced out.
I grimaced. Sure, he must have heard the curt edge to my speech. I thought he would scold me, but instead he lifted my chin.
"You're the only one I trust to make the correct judgment."
I wanted to yank away from his hold and hide the sudden glistening in my eyes, but his grip was firm, his eyes knowing. He released my chin and sat on a marble bench beneath the tart lime tree. He moved to one side, beckoning for me to join him, but I remained standing. Sitting was agreement to a forced marriage, and I didn't agree.
"The moment you could climb, you were always in the sanctum's rafters," he said in one breath.
My head snapped up. There was no accusation in his voice, only something wistful and warm. I glanced into his face, but nothing but pain and age marked his features.
"How..."
"It is difficult not to notice tutors fleeing the archival room every week," he said with the ghost of a smile. "But I never stopped you, because I wanted you to know. I wanted you to see how fraught ruling is."
He stopped and his chest heaved, shoulders dropping a fraction.
"Perhaps I hoped that by letting you see, you might forgive what I must take from you."
I stared at him. This was the longest time we had spent in each other's company. Until now, I only officially saw my father once a year on my annual age day. There were times when he had even left me gifts. Not that I was alone in this regard. My half-sisters also received small presents, clusters of gems or fashionable silks. But my presents had always been different. Fragrant sheaves of poetry or treaties of Vedic law.
valuable. I had entertained the hope that he wished to spare me from the stifling fate of my wedded half-sisters, but in the end I was no different. He rose to his feet and placed a hand on my shoulder. It felt leaden against my skin.
"Even a favored daughter is still just a daughter."
I suppressed a flinch. The warmth of his voice had disappeared, replaced with the cool monotone I knew far better.
"You have always possessed the intellect of a boy, Mayavati," he said. "Should you have the good fortune of a different sex in your next life, you might prove to be a fine ruler."
A semicircle of the Scarlet Palace guards fanned out around the Raja, and without another word he left. Despite the evening's warmth, I shivered. His words clung to me. Each sentence was its own barb from which there was no escape. For the second time today, I found myself in a place without realizing how I got there. I stepped into the harem and a flurry of sounds swelled around me.
"What did the Raja want with you?"
I masked a groan. All my guilt for the young guardsman vanished. Loose tongue. Maybe I should have scared him more. My half-sister Parvati stepped forward, and her jade-green eyes flashed with all the latent menace of someone too beautiful and too bored.
"Are you going to be a royal Devadasi?" she asked.
"No one thought you'd marry anyway." I choked back a laugh. I would have far preferred to become a Devadasi and live my life dedicated to the temple rather than fade into obscurity.
"Is it true that the Raja has denounced you?" asked one of the wives.
I turned to face the wife who had spoken. She was new, or at least I had not seen her before. A pair of buck teeth peeked out beneath thin lips. I doubted my father had wed her for her beauty or out of romantic interest. I wondered if the wife was like me, a bride of political convenience. She stared back at me, first curious and then embarrassed.
"I am to marry," I said to the room. Shrieks erupted throughout the harem. "Who?" asked Jaya. "A monster to match your horoscope? Are you sure the Raja was not lying to spare your feelings?" pressed another.
I raised my chin, determined to shove past them all until a small voice caught my attention. Gauri ran to me, brown curls flying as she threw her arms around my legs. I curved around her, burying my face in her sweet-smelling hair and gripping her shoulders tightly, as though they were the only things anchoring me to the spot.
"Are you leaving me?"
she asked. I knelt beside her, searching her face, memorizing the rosiness of her cheeks and her dimpled smile. There was no way I could lie to her. I wanted to tell her that I had no choice and that she would have to find another person to tell her stories and spin her nightmares back into dreams. But before I could wrangle out an explanation, one of the wives rushed past me, pushing me backward. I looked up to see Mother Dina and instinctively clutched Gauri closer.
"Don't poison this girl with your bad fortune," she hissed, pulling Gauri away.
Gauri protested, but Mother Dina's grip was relentless. I rose from the floor slowly. I wanted stillness, poise. I wouldn't show Gauri hysteria or rage. Mother Dina's gaze met mine. Around me, the line of women converged like a warped mirror. Here was my future, a cage fit for breeding bitterness and spite. I stumbled backward, edging along the walls as if I could avoid that fate through sheer force of will. The voices of the wives and my half-sisters billowed around me, but I couldn't separate their words. They seemed to speak as one.
"Wherever you go, you'll only bring death with you. Take your pestilence elsewhere," spat Mother Dina.
The marble beneath me was cold and dry, but my feet slipped as if I stood in water. A ringing sound filled my ears, and I sprinted out of the halls. Rage vibrated from my heels to my head as I swung open my bedroom door and sank to the floor. Where my room once glowed rosy in the sunset, now the glint of the walls shone scarlet and flame-like, poised to swallow me. Bharata wanted to be rid of me, just as much as I wanted to be rid of it. But not like this.
not like some parcel of land bartered between countries. That wasn't freedom. I thought of Gowri's face when I had knelt beside her. I thought about the words that I would have said. I had no choice but to leave. Maybe only half of that was true. I did have to leave, but the manner in which I left could be a choice that was entirely my own. I stared out the window, watching the infinite sky stretch before me. If they didn't give me a choice, then I would make my own. I would escape. Chapter 4. The Intruder. Night coaxed out the stars, my jailers. Above me, the moon burned dull silver. In the dark sky, it looked flat enough to pry and use as a mirror. I had spent the last hour staring out the window, watching the sentinels patrol the vast walls that enclosed everything I had ever seen, touched, and known for the past 17 years. After hours of staring, I had found a spot left unguarded, a hole in the palace's security. All I had to do was reach it, and then freedom. But until I could escape, other tasks clamored for my attention. I faced my room. It was the smallest of the chambers in the harem, shunted to the end of a hall that had no other occupants. They moved me here when I was 10. Mother Shastri told me that it was punishment after a swarm of bees chased my half-brother Yudhishthira into a pool of water. He had teased me that day and had kicked over a drawing that I had labored over. I had glared at him, wishing that he would go away. That's when I learned that sometimes my wishes had a strange way of coming true. Over the years, I told myself that it was all mere coincidence, but now I hoped that whatever saved me back then from Yudhishthira's bullying would save me from the Swayamvara. Stop that, I scolded myself. Hope and wishing wouldn't save me. A veil of cold purpose fell over me. Enough meetings in the sanctum had taught me the layout of the city, the demographics of its inhabitants. I could do this. I just had to move fast. I opened up my chest of clothes and began separating the gaudy fabrics from the practical, the non-essential from the necessary. I was halfway through when I heard a voice at the door. Shoving the two heaps of clothes behind a screen, I jumped to my feet.
"Maya Didi?"
called the voice. Immediately my heart sank. Gowri. I would never see Gowri again.
"It's time for my story."
In spite of myself, I smiled and opened the door for her. She glowed against the dark of the hallways, and it took every last wisp of strength not to hold her to me and weep into her hair. Tomorrow loomed in my mind. I could feel the heft of it like a solid weight against my fingers.
"Story,"
she said, shaking my arm in a mock pleading voice. "What story do you want?" It was a tradition between us. The moment evening slipped into night, Gowri would sneak into my room and I would recite fairy tales to her, embellishing the beautiful, glossing over the grotesque. Gowri clambered onto my bed, tugging the blankets around her. I sat by her side.
"Tell me about the other realms," said Gowri wistfully. "I'm going to live there when I grow up."
"Which one?" Gowri frowned.
"How many are there?"
As far as I knew, there was only one, and it had nothing in it but scheming courtiers, lying wives, and gilded menageries. But I wasn't going to tell Gowri that. In all the tomes and folklores I had read from the archives, there was no limit to the worlds around us. Somewhere unseen were demonic realms filled with laughing asuras and blackened suns. There were austere kingdoms on the peaks of mountains, where phoenixes serenaded the moon, and the halls of the gods glinted with lightning. And there was our own, human world, mortal, with only the comfort of stories to keep away the chill of death. "There's thousands, but mainly three. Think of it like cities within kingdoms," I said, when I saw her brows scrunch up. "There's our world, which has you, and is therefore the best one." Gowri grinned. "Then there's the other world, with
with its night bazaar and strange but beautiful beings. And then I dropped my voice to a whisper. There's the netherworld, which holds Naraka, the realm of the dead. Gauri shivered.
What's there?
Demons, I said, raising my arms like a giant bat. Her eyes widened and she curled closer to me.
Tell me about the night bazaar.
I worried the edges of my dress. This was the part I made different from the stories, but Gauri didn't need to know that. It's a market for the otherworld people, the beings in our stories, like Apsaras who dance in the heavens, or Gandharvas who play celestial music, or even Naginis who want to buy new scales for their serpent tails, all of them. Gauri wrinkled a nose, unimpressed.
They buy dresses there?
Much, much more, I said. It's a place for purchasing nightmares and dreams sweet as rasmalai. You can buy sleepless nights or trade your full name for a wish. It's where demon mercenaries lend out their magic like colorful ribbons. There's memories of beautiful women for sale and 1,000 potions for things from a broken heart to a sore tooth.
Really?
Asked Gauri, her voice barely above a whisper. I shrugged. Maybe. But I've told you, and now it's time to sleep. No more tales. I rolled to the side, feigning sleep, when Gauri poked me.
How will I find it when I'm done growing up?
If I knew, don't you think I would have tried to get there already? I laughed. It's hard to find, Gauri.
I can find it, she piped up. Last week I found slippers beneath a statue, but I don't know why they were there.
I tried to stifle my laugh with a cough. I may have hidden those last week. They belonged to Mother Dina and had the most irritating tassels. And to add insult to injury, they had bells.
Did you tell anyone? No. I thought an Apsara had left them there. Maybe she wanted them back and she'd get mad if I took them.
So you think finding hidden slippers qualifies you to enter the other world? Gauri blinked at me, as though this were the most obvious conclusion. I'll tell you where to find it, then, I said, laughing. Truthfully, the folktales never said how to get there, but Gauri looked at me so expectantly I couldn't imagine any harm in playing up her imagination. You have to go when the creatures are at their weakest, on the night of a new moon. The other world is on the other side of a moonbeam, and inside 100 lotus petals. It's in that space of time right before you fall asleep. Gauri muffled a yawn and looked sleepily at the door.
I'm going to go someday.
Are you? I asked, wrapping my arm around her.
You should take me with you. I'll take you, Didi.
Her voice was heavy with sleepiness, but her body was curled, tight and tense. I knew she was trying to keep herself awake, drawing out the minutes where we could lie side by side, but we both knew she had to leave.
Will we see each other again? She asked softly.
Yes. Gauri fell silent.
In this life?
I turned to face her. What do you mean?
Mother Urvashi says that if I'm bad in this life, then I'll come back as a goat in my next life, which means that there is another life.
Gauri didn't look at me, focusing instead on tightly twisting the hem of her gown.
So, will you see me again before I'm a goat?
You're too good to be a goat.
Didi, you're not answering me.
I know, I said into her hair. I just don't know.
But if we were sisters this time, we would be sisters again, right?
Of course.
And we were sisters in our last life too, right?
Naturally.
What do you think we were?
Asked Gauri, looking up at me.
Princesses?
Nothing as boring as that, I said. We could have been stars, you and me, and not the mean ones that blindly spell out the rest of your life, but beautiful constellations hovering far above fate. I pointed to an open window.
We could have been something magical, talking bears that built a palace in a mango tree,
or twin makaras with tails so